Christmas is coming. I'm sure that hasn't escaped you. In my local supermarket, Christmas goods started appearing in mid-September, and by now they dominate the displays in several aisles, and I'm already sick of the gaudy sight of it all. If Margie was still in here, she would tell you I'm rather a Scrooge when it comes to Christmas festivities. So I normally stand up here at the beginning of Advent and remind you that Advent is not Christmas, and that it's not only about anticipating and preparing for Christmas. It's about more than that. And that's true, but it actually is about that too, and I've been persuaded to lay aside my prejudices just a little this year and explore some of the preparing for Christmas dimensions of this season of Advent. Which doesn't mean that we're about to start singing Christmas carols or putting up pictures of Santa visiting the manger in the stable. We're preparing, but we're not there yet. The readings for this first Sunday of Advent probably seem about as un-Christmassy as you can get. They've got much more of the earth-shattering end-of-the-world thing going on, especially the reading from Luke's Gospel. There will be signs in the sun, the moon and the stars, and on the earth distress among nations, confused by the roaring of the sea and the waves. People will faint from fear and foreboding of what is coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to take place, stand up, raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. Un-Christmassy, perhaps, but they do have a lot to say about anticipation and expectation. And perhaps if they seem un-Christmassy, it's because our concept of Christmas has broken loose from its moorings and become something other than the gospel. These words about traumatic chaos that shakes the earth should be sounding different to our generation. Not because it's entirely new, although for sure people in Alaska today, when they hear Jesus say there will be great earthquakes, will probably be thinking that he could have been referring to yesterday. And when the people in churches in Sulawesi, Indonesia, hear these words today, nations confused by the roaring of the sea and the waves, they will probably hear them in a particularly poignant way. But tsunamis are not new, neither are earthquakes and cyclones and bushfires. Sydney hasn't had a tsunami, but it rained so hard up there last week that when people posted fake photos of the Harbour Bridge turned into a waterfall, a lot of Sydneysiders fell for it and thought they were real. Such was the downpour that the pictures actually seemed believable. But the fact that we refer to such downpours as being of biblical proportions reminds us that freak storms have been going on for a very long time. But although extreme weather events are not new, our generation has an understanding of why they are becoming more frequent and more violent and more extreme. We can see that they're not just isolated incidents, but that there is an escalating pattern. The climate is changing. The extremes are more violent, and we know that we've brought it on ourselves. We have a top temperature of 18 degrees today. We're expecting 36 next Friday. This is something that the average school child can understand well enough and take to the streets over. But as the federal government has demonstrated over and over in the past few years, knowing how to face it and what to do about it is an entirely different thing. The last thing our Conservative government wants to do is inspire a new generation of placard-waving political activists, But as we saw on Friday, their paralysis over what to do is achieving exactly that. The prospect of changing ourselves can be more traumatic than enduring the change that goes on seemingly out of our control all around us. But these two changes, the external and the internal, are far from unrelated. Jesus uses the images of planetary and climactic chaos not so much for their own sake, but to warn us of the earth-shattering nature of the changes that are coming upon us with his coming into the world. Everything that Jesus is on about is so different from the present ways that the world operates that it makes the kind of changes needed to halt the pace of climate change seem like small potatoes. When the ways of Jesus begin to seriously impact on the world, it will be traumatic, tumultuous, earth-shattering. Kingdoms will crumble. Empires will fall. Great political parties will tear themselves asunder. Financial institutions will go into meltdown and be publicly humiliated. Powerful nations will be mired in senseless, unwinnable wars. The earth will be shaken to its foundations. Does that sound like our expectations of Christmas? No. But perhaps it should. The reason that it doesn't is that we have reduced the story of Christ's coming to a cute baby story, and we've largely erased from memory even the aspects of the baby story that foreshadow the chaos and trauma that his coming into the world is going to cause. The shepherds and the wise men are popular stories, but who wants to hear that the reigning dictator went ballistic and dispatched death squads to kill all the babies to make sure that this baby could not have a chance to shake the foundations of the earth? That story doesn't fit Christmas's family-friendly G-rated image. Social psychologists say that one of the ways that we react to threatening news, which we feel powerless to do anything about, is to kind of ignore it, to suppress it from consciousness so that we become oblivious to it. And that one of the ways that we do that is to distract ourselves from it with entertainments and consumption and festivities and intoxicants. In other words, we party ourselves into oblivion. And what did Jesus say in the reading we heard? Be on your guard so that your hearts are not weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life, and that day catch you unexpectedly like a trap. Dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life. In other words, compulsive partying and mind-numbing intoxication and keeping up with the lifestyle indicators of socially expected patterns of festive consumption. In our prayers of confession at this time of year, we acknowledge that we are prone to reducing our preparation for Christ's coming to reckless expense and trivialities. Perhaps it's no wonder. It's difficult not to get caught up in the massive wave of consumption and partying that engulfs our world at this time of year. But, says Jesus, be on your guard. He's not saying you can't go to parties or that you can't buy Christmas presents, but he's warning against doing so mindlessly and just surrendering to the escapism of it all. The Christmas that we anticipate and prepare for is not just the festivities that celebrate the birth of a baby. The baby is an important part of the story and of the message, but the usual tendency is to kind of freeze the story just there and allow nothing that would disrupt the sentimentality and festive cycle of it all. The Christmas that we anticipate and prepare for is more than that. It's also the beginning of the end. It is also the breaking in of a new world, which will shake the earth to its foundations and bring many of its cherished institutions crashing down. The Christmas that we anticipate and prepare for is the celebration of the God who becomes flesh in the fragile promise of a baby yet unborn, but whose birthing labour pains cause the whole earth to shudder and heave, because what is being born is not just a new baby, but a new world, a new culture, a new way of being. What is being born is life itself, is freedom and hope and healing and promise. What is being born is the new day of justice, when all the world is set free from its enemies and salvation is made flesh. And for the coming of that day on this, we work and pray.